Coming up, Christopher Murphy tells us about his protagonist struggling to prove he's not like his father, but is he? And Justine talks about Palm Springs Noir, an anthology that includes a short story by Michael Kraft. I'm Brad Shreve, and you're listening to Queer Writers of Crime, featuring LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Justine, the guest today is Christopher Murphy. But as usual, before the interview, you have your book recommendation, and I always have a couple things to talk about.
Okay, let's ease into it, Brad. Let's see what you got on the table.
I don't have a whole lot this week, so people aren't going to have to hear me ramble. I'm not even going to mention that certain person that turns me on.
Thank God you didn't mention it.
No, I wouldn't mention Paul Rudd at all.
Yeah.
Anyway, I want to remind people, podcasts are coming to Facebook. If you have a page, we'll be able to put the podcast on Facebook, which can really help increase our listenership. And have had quite a few people click like on the page. We would like more. We'd like to make it a place for people to have discussions about queer crime or queer novels in general, and can talk about Justine's recommendations or talk about the guests that I have on. And also, what would help us is this page is pretty new and we're already getting trolls.
Yeah. Trolls.
Why does it matter if they're queer? Isn't a good writer a good writer? What's the point? That was probably, I think, the first comment.
Yeah.
But then the second comment was a guy that says, quit pushing your sexuality on me or something like that.
Yeah, Pride Month's over, you know, and now we're in July and the world's back to normal, sadly.
And this guy that said, quit pushing your sexuality on me or whatever, I first wrote a nasty comment back. And then I checked out his profile, and it's all about religion. He's a very devout religious man. But I also noticed that he's raising money for the National Suicide Prevention Hotline.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know what? I think that nasty message was the wrong thing to do. So I went back to the page, and my response to his nasty comment, I deleted it.
Good.
And I said, I just want to let you know that I saw on your profile that you are raising money for the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, which is important for all people, gay and straight. It's a troubling issue in our country, and therefore I gave a donation on your page. I think that's a nicer way to handle it.
I think so.
But if we can get some more, you know, we're going to get these folks. So if people join the page and we get these kind of comments,
drown them out with friendly comments.
Make friendly comments. You know, if you want to get nasty, if that's your way, do it. But yeah, it's probably better if you say something nice.
Yeah. Talk about the books and the authors.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's like, do you remember the... It happened just a few weeks ago, the boat that exploded with the homophobes on it?
Yes.
Okay, so just in case people don't know, there was a boat that had a rainbow flag on it, and this other boat started circling them and screaming all kinds of homophobic things to them. And out of the blue, for no reason, their boat exploded.
With leaking fuel and a spark, just so everybody doesn't know, it didn't blow up out of the water for no reason.
No. But it was like totally instant karma.
Yes.
And the beautiful part of the story is, who do you think went and saved these people?
Yes. The boat that was the boat with the rainbow flag was right there on the scene.
Yes. I don't know if they appreciated it or not, but it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, well.
Kill them with kindness.
Yeah, it's the kind of story that belongs in a novel someplace.
Exactly. So there's going to be a link in the show notes to the Facebook page, or you can just search for Queer Writers of Crime in Facebook. Either way, please go there and click like, and we'd love to have you join in some kind of discussion or even just comment things I post. I don't know. And Justine will post some things too.
Oh, yeah.
And that's really all I have. I mean, I could sit here and make things up, but there's no reason to.
That's right. I mean, here we are. We're on the end of a holiday weekend. So, enjoy the fireworks, guys.
And plus, here where I have my studio, I have to turn off the air conditioning because otherwise it shows up on the microphone. So I am sweating like crazy. So
thank you for sharing, Brad.
Let's segue over to your book recommendation.
We can talk a lot sooner, huh?
Exactly. So what book are you going to talk about today?
Well, I'm talking about Palm Springs Noir. And this is kind of off our usual beaten path. And when we were talking about it, you said your show, your rules, and we wanted to go ahead and do this one.
That's the truth.
It's a collection of 14 short stories. They're all noir, and I like noir every now and then. And for people who don't really know what the genre is, they're these kind of stories that really all's well and that doesn't end well. Just at the end, everybody's just kind of in a very dark place. And along the way, they solve some problems, but they, you know, if they get out of one trouble, they end up at the end in another trouble.
Which is very interesting that this book takes place in Palm Springs, because it's totally the non-noirist place you can think of. So I think that's cool that they chose that.
And, you know, Palm Springs is quite friendly, shall we say. They were the first city to have an all-LGBTQ city council.
Absolutely.
Let me just say, of these 14 stories, only two of them are gay, even though some of the writers are more than that. The writers are gay. So Michael Kraft is one of the stories. He's been promoting it. Michael Kraft, who wrote The Choirmeister.
Michael Kraft was our very first guest when we started the podcast.
Exactly. And so we really wanted to support this book that he's part of. And all of the stories are good. I'm going to give this book a glowing recommendation because all of them are very, very well written. They have some incredible authors. You've got one guy, T. Jefferson Parker. He's won 2 Edgar Awards for Best Novel and an Edgar for Best Short Stories and a Los Angeles Times Book Prize. And then Eduardo Santiago has won a Edmund White Debut Fiction Award. And Edmund White was one of the Violet Quill members. And of course, as you know, Michael Kraft. And they're just all top-notch authors. And the stories are all noir and all really good. They involve murder. They involve twists and turns. In Michael's story, the young man, well, he's not a young man anymore. He was a young man when he was married to this doctor. He is now pushing 60, divorced from his ex-husband, and, you know, is working for this Airbnb kind of service where they do luxury rentals around Palm Springs. And he's the guy who's got to show up in the khaki pants and the bright yellow shirt to kind of check people in and make sure everything's fine and show them around the properties.
And as I said, khaki pants and bright yellow shirts is not what you would picture in a noir novel.
No, it's not. And it is that is probably the only bright spot in the entire piece is that yellow shirt. There are some others, you know, and there's dead bodies in all of them. Sometimes the main character causes the dead body. Sometimes the main character happens upon the dead body. Every single one of the stories is a star. I really like it. It gets a glowing recommendation. Michael said he wouldn't necessarily push it to somebody who's looking only for gay fiction, but these stories are so well that lovers of crime and people who like good writing will enjoy them no matter what. So it's Palm Springs Noir. It is out today. Today is the release day. So go and snap it up on Amazon.
And I want to say something. I hear a lot in Facebook groups, I'll see them, and actually some people have told me they only read novels with queer characters.
Yes.
And that actually makes me just as sad as if a straight person said, oh, I would never read a novel with a gay character in it.
Well, you know, not all of us have a lot of time for reading. So if you're reading 2, 3, 4 books a year, I can see wanting to trim down your reading.
Okay, you got me there.
Yeah, I mean, you can pick it up and just read the 2 stories that are gay and maybe occasionally, you know, maybe dip into another one because you like them so much. I will let you know which the gay stories are. They are Eric Buettner, who wrote The Guest, and then Michael Kraft's story is the VIP check-in, and it's set in Little Tuscany, which is an upscale neighborhood in Palm Springs. And they're all terrific.
So again, it's Palm Springs Noir?
Yeah. And the editor is, and she writes one of the stories, but the editor who gets the credit for pulling all of these together is Barbara DeMarco Barrett.
And I don't know if you're aware, I don't know if it's every year or every 2 years. The noir series like this it's been done many, many, many times. They pick a different city each time.
Yes.
And then ask authors. I don't know if they're particularly live in that particular city.
I think they do. They some of them live there and some of them just have connections there. But they're all familiar with the area. And each of the tales, you recognize the places and they can't be told anywhere else.
So definitely read this one, especially since Michael Kraft has a story in it and Justine loved the book. She enjoyed every story. But if you live in a different city than Palm Springs, when you're done reading this one, look it up. They have covered so many cities. It'd be odd if you're in a medium to larger size city and it's not on that list.
Or they could be doing it next year in the next volume or the volume after. They haven't done all the cities yet.
No, you can't hit them all. But I think that's their goal, probably, to hit them all.
That's right. Sounds great.
All right. Well, on to Christopher Murphy. Thank you, Justine.
See you next week.
Please join our new Facebook page where you'll get updates about the show and we'll just talk about whatever comes up. Search for Queer Writers of Crime on Facebook or simply click the link in the show notes. Christopher, I have a question for you.
Shoot.
Your most recent novel, The Other Side of the Mirror, which came out last year, the main character is Jace Lancaster.
Lannister.
I apologize.
That's okay.
Jace has a dark secret.
He does.
Yes. It's in your blurb. So do you want to share what the secret is?
I can't because people need to read the book. Okay. But what I will tell you is that the story does center around Jace Lannister. He is the son of an infamous black serial killer dubbed the Brooklyn Butcher, who murdered 19 people during the early 90s. He was caught when Jace was in high school. The book picks up when Jace is an adult. And Jace has, you know, kind of reinvented himself. He's changed his name. He's moved. He's trying to build a life that's free of his father's dark legacy. But of course, you know, things go awry and mayhem ensues and all that good stuff.
We're going to talk a little about Jace in a little bit. But in your previous novel, Where the Boys Are, Quinn Harris is dealing with a certain situation. And what does that happen to be?
So Quinn Harris runs into an old teacher of his who he adored and looked up to and kind of helped him realize who he was as a queer, you know, man. Everyone's kind of had that one teacher that you kind of had a little crush on or really looked up to. And he meets him randomly one night at a bar and is surprised to find out that, you know, he's also queer and he has an opportunity to, you know, kind of maybe test out, you know, a fantasy that he's had, but he discovers that the teacher is in fact a serial killer.
Right. That's what I was getting to. So The Other Side of the Mirror, we have a serial killer. And in Where the Boys Are, we have a serial killer. And we're going to talk about what is it with you and serial killers. but first, I have some things to say.
Okay.
Christopher Murphy is an activist, artist, and the author of the breakout thriller Where the Boys Are and The Other Side of the Mirror. Christopher is a graduate of Virginia Commonwealth University and the Hurston Wright Foundation. As a graphic designer, copywriter, marketer by day, and author by night, Christopher can usually be found creating and designing behind the bright neon glow of his laptop. When he's not writing, he enjoys traveling to new destinations. He's a shameless thrill seeker, lover of roller coasters and all things that go fast. Christopher lives and works out of his home in Las Vegas with his hubs and their two dogs, and he is currently writing his next novel. It's great to have you on because we never used to have thrillers on as guests. There's a reason for that. The name of the podcast used to be called Gay Mystery Podcast. My tagline has always been featuring LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thrillers. But because gay was in the title, I had to kind of seek out other people in the alphabet to be on the show. And because it was mystery, I occasionally would get somebody say, well, I have a thriller. Are you willing to let me be on your show? And I'm like, sure. So I eventually changed it 7 months ago, I think, to Queer Writers of Crime. And I no longer have those questions. I'm not having to search people out. I if I'm not getting as diverse as I want to, I'll search people out. But it was a good move. So it's good to have another thriller writer on the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. It's good to be here.
There are very few people of color in the LGBT crime genre. Mm-hmm. How can we change that?
I think just by telling the stories that, you know, are in our heads and getting it out on paper and getting it out into the world. You know, I think when I look at the thriller genre and, you know, crime thriller genre, you know, there's not a lot of diversity. There's not a lot of people of color. You know, even the covers of the books kind of all look fairly similar, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the men on the cover who, you know, are very handsome and maybe sometimes shirtless, and then they all just kind of look the same. So I think having these different voices is important to have in the genre, and, you know, not being afraid to use your voice and tell these stories, no matter if you think someone may identify with it or like it or not, but just get it out there.
You bring up the covers. I'm glad you brought those up. It drives me crazy that so many mystery novels, the cover looks like the cover of a Harlequin romance novel.
Yes. Thank you for saying it.
Yeah, neither of your books have that. And actually, I like the covers very nice. You did well.
Thank you.
So now we're going to get back to Jace. You told us a little bit about him. What more can you tell us?
Yeah, so Jace is a unique character because, you know, in the genre, he's Black, he's queer. He's also a bit of an unreliable protagonist in a lot of ways because of the trauma that he's experienced being the son of this, you know, infamous murderer. He has trouble with remembering things a certain way sometimes. He sleepwalks. He's on his medication, or maybe he has gone off his medication, you know. So he's a little bit unreliable, which is exciting because it makes him just as much of a suspect in the book as anyone else. The story is very much a twisty crime thriller, you know, that's going to keep you guessing until the last page. But it's also a story about generational trauma and the things that we inherit from our fathers, for good or for worse. And I think you really see that in Jace. He has troubles with his reflection. You know, he's getting older and he's seeing his father in himself more and more as he looks in the mirror and catch the glimpse of this reflection or goes about his day. And his biggest fear is that, what if I am just like my father? What if I am capable of doing these awful things? So he's a really complex character, but he also has a great, I think, dark sense of humor about things that I enjoy writing. So I think there's a good balance there. He's trying to be as normal as he can, but there's, you know, he's in the middle of a murder investigation. Anyone could be the suspect. Anyone could be the killer.
I like that he has a good circle of friends that are supportive.
Yes.
Regarding his mental state that he goes through. And getting to that, one of the earliest people you introduce in the story is Dr. Gretchen Kessler, who is a psychiatrist and doles out his medication and prescribes his medication. In the early stages, you don't give what specifically his diagnosis is. Can you say what it is?
It's a number of different, and I don't want to give too much away. It's definitely, you know, post-traumatic trauma from his childhood. That is really what it centers around. But, you know, he's definitely gone through depression, you know, a lot of different things that you would expect from someone in his situation who's grown up in the spotlight of his father's shadow.
You know, you mentioned he looks in the mirror and he sees a lot of his father in him. I find myself, I'll catch myself saying something that sounds just like my dad. And I'm like, oh my God. So I can imagine if your father is a serial killer.
Yeah.
That would be an especially big concern.
Yeah. And, you know, he's also a Black serial killer. So, I mean, you know, add that in. And, you know, with his last name, which is pretty unique, it's easy to kind of, for people to connect the dots. You know, it's very hard for him to shy away from his childhood and who he is.
I can't recall any. Have there been any Black serial killers of any prominence?
Actually, yeah. There's been a handful. Most recently, Samuel Little comes to mind. He was convicted of 3 murders in California. And once he was in prison, he actually confessed to a lot more. He claimed to have taken credit for like 93 murders, which would have made him one of the most prolific serial killers in American history. The FBI tied him to 50 before he died. He just died recently, last December. He was 80 years old, died in prison.
50, they know for sure.
50, they were able to tie to him for sure. So probably more.
Wow. That's scary and amazing.
Yeah. So it does happen, but you know, you don't hear about it as often, which I think is something else exciting about this book.
Well, I alluded to before your introduction, what is it with you and serial killers?
I promise I'm not like a serial killer junkie or, you know, fanatic or a super fan or anything. But I think there is something interesting about what makes someone click or what makes them wired in that manner. But I'll say this as well, you know, with my books, you know, a lot of the villains are serial killers, but that's not really quite what the book is so much about or focused on. It's more about the people left behind in the aftermath and the things that they discover about the killings or themselves surrounding this serial killer. So it's more about the victims. It's more about the people kind of left behind in the aftermath of the killings.
It's difficult to tell a story when it comes to crime fiction, but how much of it can you tell us?
I can tell you that Jace does find himself in a really difficult situation when a murder happens that is textbook, you know, what his father has done. His father went to prison for his crimes. He confessed to what he did, and he killed himself in prison shortly into his sentence, which in a lot of ways made things worse because a lot of the families felt that, you know, they were really just robbed of justice all the way around. And it was just a major slap in the face. So he's always had to deal with that and kind of the anniversary of that and, you know, certain killings. So when this murder happens, that is textbook, the Brooklyn Butcher, everyone kind of looks at him, you know, so he has to deal with that. He has to cope with a lot of that aftermath. And the question comes up, who did do it? You know, it is a bit of a whodunit. And Jace's name is not off the table as far as suspects go. So this book, I will say, I am working on a sequel. This book is really about Jace discovering who he is outside of the son of the Brooklyn Butcher and kind of unraveling this first mystery where Jace finds himself in the middle of a murder investigation.
Something I'm curious about, in your bio, you talk about you've lived in Virginia. Yeah, you're currently living in Vegas.
I am.
The story is in Portland, Oregon, and you seem to know a lot about Portland. Was that home at one time?
It was. I lived there for 2 years.
Okay. Jace and his friend Sid met at a Black Lives Matter protest. Portland is known as kind of a liberal mecca.
Yes.
Why is it the place conservatives like to point at and say, look at all the problems?
It's hard to point at almost just one thing. I mean, I can only speak from my experience living there. And Portland as a city is very much boots on the ground, you know, grassroots, speak out when you see something that's wrong. There are protests that I saw happening quite frequently, even outside of the Black Lives Matter, you know, protests. We would be at dinner and, you know, see protests and parade, you know, walking down the street in the middle of the night. You know, that's just how they get down in Portland. And I think that's fantastic. I think it's just a lot of liberal, like-minded people who just want to make positive changes in the world. Part of that too, that kind of bleeds into the book a little bit, is that there's such a really strong queer community there as well, that's super, you know, supportive and involved with everything going on. So I wanted to really incorporate that aspect into the book as well, along with my experiences living in Portland. I would see tons of signs on people's lawns, you know, with Black Lives Matter, you know, signs. People are just very outspoken and not afraid to say what's on their hearts. And I don't know if that's not necessarily just a Portland thing. I think that's maybe more so a West Coast thing. It could be. I love, you know, being back on the West Coast. I love the people. I love the vibe out here. Vegas, I think we chatted about that a little bit. It's starting to heat up here in Vegas. So if I can just make it through the summer, I think I'll be okay.
You will get used to it.
Yeah. But Portland is definitely near and dear to my heart as far as places I've lived. And I just really love the vibe and just how woke everyone is.
I was really surprised. I always heard such wonderful things about Portland. And I took a drive from Seattle to Portland, actually from Portland to Seattle, doesn't matter. And I was really shocked that once you got out of Portland, it reminded me a lot of rural North Carolina. It suddenly turns very bright red.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to drive from Portland for work, you know, a couple of places. And yeah, it is like kind of a stark contrast once you get out of Portland. But I miss it in a lot of ways, you know. It's beautiful, great food scene as well, which I think I also try to, you know, incorporate a little bit within the book here as well. So you'll see some real restaurants from Portland incorporated that were favorites of mine too.
Yeah, there's a lot of restaurants they go to and mention. And actually, California is very similar into the way of describing Portland and Oregon itself.
Yeah.
People think of it as this liberal, bright blue state, and that is really not true. If you took out San Francisco and Los Angeles, it would practically be like Texas.
Yeah.
People aren't aware of that. It's a very rural state overall, but fortunately, because you have the two big cities, they're liberal-minded.
Yeah. Something else, Portland is one of those cities, I think, that has the fewest amount of churches or like religious, like people are like less affiliated with like certain religions, like in Portland, like, and you definitely see like less churches. I spent a lot of time in Richmond, Virginia, and Richmond has tons and tons of churches, like almost like on every single corner, so much that the ASL sign for sign language for Richmond is you make a seven and you do like an R, because there's like somehow it connects like to churches, and there's just seven hills. And yeah, it's very complicated. But yeah, so that's something too about Portland. It's not a lot of religious affiliation, which is a reason why Sid moved there, because his father owned like a mega church. He wanted to get away from that like as far as possible. So that was a reason why he moved to Portland.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book about the churches, and I think you said 40% of people in Portland identify as either atheist or agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to the rest of the country, that's huge.
Yeah, yeah, it's really, really high.
I'm going to take some guesses here from your book.
Okay.
You can tell me if I'm right or wrong, but they're gut feelings I had as I was reading the book.
Okay.
Jace and his friend Derek dated for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And they met through a speed dating event.
Yes, one of my favorite scenes in the book, by the way.
Was that based on experience?
No, I never speed dated. I'm married. I've been married. Next April will be 10 years. But during my single day, I never got a chance to like speed date. It wasn't even really a thing that I had an opportunity to do. But maybe that's why I wrote it in the book.
Yeah, I saw that and I clicked and I said, I bet Christopher did that. Something just tells me. So I'm wrong, actually. So
yeah.
The other thing that came to mind, in Jace's office, there is an autographed novel by Elin Harris.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to tell you, my husband is a huge Elin Harris fan.
Oh, good.
As much as he has bugged me about it, I still have not read one of his novels.
You have to.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, because that one particular book was there very prominently mentioned when you described The Room, I'm going to guess that Elin Harris is an inspiration of yours.
Absolutely. And for those who are, you know, maybe a little less familiar with Elin Harris, he's, I would say, definitely one of the godfathers of Black queer literature. He kind of made his mark because he was talking about a topic that not a lot of other people were talking about at the time. And that was Black men who were on the down low. And so he kind of spins that into this beautiful coming out, coming into your own love story with fantastic characters. And his first book, Invisible Life, which is mentioned in my book, it's that book that is always kind of passed on or given to like the next person, the next generation.
Uh-huh.
I love that book. And I passed my book on to a good friend of mine. So I no longer have my first initial copy of it, but I do have my signed copy. I got a chance to meet Elin Harris. You can tell your husband this Elin Harris story if you like. I got a chance to meet him. He was speaking at a Women for Women conference, which, as the title suggests, means that it was a conference for women, But a friend of mine's mother was not able to attend. She had this extra ticket. And so I totally just crashed this conference, basically. I was the only man there for his portion of the conference. And I had the audacity to get up and even ask him a question. And I think my question to him was, you know, what advice would you give a young author like myself who's trying to write and make something of their writing career? And his advice was to just keep doing you. Always be true to yourself. People may not get it, but just stay true to who you are as a writer. And so that was great. Afterwards, he was taking pictures, signing books. And so it's finally my turn. I run up to him. I have my book to sign. And he was allowing photos, but they had kind of stopped because of time. Mm-hmm. And so I had my friend with her camera. At that day, this wasn't even like a phone camera. It was like an actual like camera. And I was telling her, you know, take as many pictures as you can. And so time is going on and people in line are starting to get like a little like cranky. And so he stands up and he's like, you know, stop, you know, everything. He's like, I will take some time with Chris and like take a picture. And like, he got up and like posed for like a picture, like with me at that point. So very nice guy, super sweet, super talented and very much missed.
What was it like meeting? It sounds like he was an idol to you or is an idol to you. What was that feeling that you were having at that particular moment?
It was a lot of nervousness, but it was also a sense of pride to see someone who looked like me having this success and doing what I aspire to do. So it was really a very good memory that I have. Good memory for sure. Meeting him and also, you know, kind of a turning point within my own writing career, I think.
Sounds like a great experience.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, my other guess is, I know you lived in Georgia, and you told me, I forget the city. It's not Atlanta.
Augusta.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Atlanta is known for, everybody you talk to will argue what place has the best hot wings.
Oh, gosh.
And you mentioned hot wings in the story, very hot wings.
Yeah.
Is that true also in Augusta?
There are a couple of decent spots, I would say, in Augusta, but I would say Augusta has one of the best places for, if you like a good crab boil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like the juicy crab in Augusta is phenomenal. My husband and I, we love doing that every now and then. And we try different places, you know, everywhere we go, but nothing has beaten that juicy crab in Augusta, Georgia. So if you're ever there, go to the juicy crab there. And if you love good, like kind of, you know, homemade desserts, go to a little spot called Boll Weevil. And it's like this little like dessert sweetery type of place. And they have like the most amazing cheesecakes and, you know, homemade desserts and stuff, Southern style that, you know, you can't really get like anywhere else. So yeah, but hot wings, you know, they're okay. Don't go for the hot wings.
This has been the Augusta Travel Bureau recommendations from Christopher Murphy.
There you go.
Other than Elin Harris, what other authors have inspired you?
He's been a major inspiration. I don't know if I'll say this author has inspired me, but I don't know. I used to read my mother's old V.C. Andrews books back in the day when I was like way too young to read V.C. Andrews books, I'll say. So that was, you know, maybe like an influence. Right now I'm reading Blind Spot by Brenda Novak. It's the fourth book in her Evelyn Talbert series. So I'm enjoying that, trying to get through the series. I am writing the sequel to this book at the same time. So that's kind of tricky. I don't usually like to read and write for something myself at the same time. But I'm a big fan of Brenda Novak. Yeah, but that's I'm kind of trying to take a break right now from a lot of other books until I can get the sequel done. I'm trying to hunker down and crank it out. I think for me, it just kind of goes back to the classics. I had like a actual like book set that my mother gave me that had Mark Twain and, you know, and all those classic books that you were supposed to read, you know, as a kid, you know, in school. And I think tapping into My mother's like a huge reader. Like she'll read three books at a time, which I can't. Yeah. Two is like maybe the most I'll do, but she'll read like 3 books at a time. And so I think I would just maybe borrow some of her books, including the B.C. Andrews books. And that just kind of opened up maybe a different world for me as a kid. Yeah. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, it did.
Okay.
I cannot read 2 books at the same time. Mainly romance readers, and I know some mystery readers, will read a book a day. And I wish I could read that fast. But no matter how fast of a reader I get, I can't imagine reading 2 books at the same time. It just...
Yeah, my mother does it all the time. 2 or sometimes 3. I don't know how she does it.
A lot of people do it. I commend them.
Yeah.
For keeping them straight.
More power to them.
Yeah, especially if they're different genres.
Yeah, yeah.
So what brought you to crime novels, thrillers particularly?
I think I'm also a big movie film buff, and I love watching thrillers on the big screen. And I love anything that will keep me guessing. I love being in the middle of something and saying, what is this? Is this a horror story? Is this a crime thriller? You know, I love that and not being able to tell what's going to happen next. And I think as writers, you know, we kind of have the ability a lot of times to kind of deconstruct things, plots, and see, oh, okay, well, this is probably going to happen next and yada, yada, yada. I love when I just can't guess what's going to happen. And so I think that passion has bled into my writing a lot. And this book in particular, I think, is the book that helped me find my lane. You know, I write thrillers centered around queer characters of color. But within all of my books, you really won't know or be able to guess what's going to happen until the absolute end. I love to keep people guessing. That's my thing.
Well, I've said it time and time again on this show, and I'm going to say it once again.
Say it again.
Mystery readers are dying to figure out who did it.
Yeah.
But if they do figure it out, they're really mad.
Right, right. And that's why I won't read certain things or even watch certain things, you know, because I hate figuring out what's going to happen 5 minutes in. That's a good reason why I actually don't read a lot of romance novels too, or watch a lot of like romance film or whatnot, because I know the guy is going to get the guy or the guy is going to get the girl at the end. So I'll just take that hour and a half of my life and I'll work on my book instead or something, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I love just that surprise element.
Yeah, I believe the Hallmark Channel has 2 writers that work for the network and 4 sets.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Lots of people love it. I'm like, okay, they hate each other and they're going to love each other at the end. I figured it out. Let's move on.
Exactly.
But some people are comfortable with that. They like, it's what they like. And so that's what they hold on to. And that's great.
That's great for them.
Whereas we were at my in-laws and my father-in-law put in a movie and I can't remember what it was, but it was a movie. Not only did I not know anything about, I had never even heard about it. It was totally new to me. And the fact that I knew absolutely nothing about this film, and fortunately turned out to be a good film, was really cool.
Yeah.
It made it a lot more fun. Sometimes you watch the previews and you know everything.
Right, which is the worst.
Yes.
I hate that. But sometimes, and this happened recently, you'll see a preview and you're kind of like it's this new movie on Hulu. I kind of forget. False Positive, I think it's called. And I was halfway through the preview and I just stopped watching the preview because I was like, this looks crazy. I have no idea what's going on. This looks fresh. I don't want to have spoiled, you know. I want to just watch it from start to finish and not have any more clues about what's going to happen. And it was a good movie.
These trailers that tell everything. Ryan Reynolds has a movie coming up, and I love Ryan Reynolds, not only because I find him incredibly hot. He's very charming and funny. That's actually more what makes him sexy. Mm-hmm. But this movie coming out where he lives in a video game. And the 2 trailers, I feel like, why should I even watch the movie?
Right.
I know what's going to happen. I'm sure there's more than what they're showing, but I feel like I've watched the movie already, just the Cliff Notes version.
Right. And so as a writer, you know, I, having gone through that frustration, like I never want my readers to experience that, you know. Yeah. I've had people message me or call me up and say, I just threw your book across the room because I can't believe like this happened. I had no idea this twist was coming. So every book that I do is loaded with twists, it's loaded with surprises. Yeah, I think that's very much within my lane. I want to have that thriller that talks about queer characters, characters of color, diversity, that has important messaging throughout. That's also just going to be one hell of a good book that's going to, you know, keep you guessing and have a satisfying ending. So
that takes skill. So good on you.
Thank you.
And this is about you, not about me, but I want to share something with you.
Yeah.
Because you're talking about books with queer characters. My first novel is A Body in a Bathhouse.
I saw that. On your website. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, when the audiobook came out, the very first review came out and the guy said, gay authors need to learn that 80% of the characters in their novels don't have to be gay. I read the title and I should have figured that out. And I'm like, yeah, if you read the title and the murder took place in a bathhouse, you can pretty much guess that all the suspects are going to be gay.
Yeah.
Or if they're not, there's a reason. Yeah, you know, why even mention it? You shouldn't have read it to begin with if it bothers you. So
right.
I tend not to read the reviews. That one actually I stumbled on by accident because I didn't know where reviews were on audiobooks. But it made me laugh. It didn't upset me. It made me laugh.
Yeah.
You thought it was going to be gay people bathhouse. You should have trusted your judgment.
Exactly. Listen to that voice.
Sex.
Mm-hmm.
I love to talk about sex and mysteries and crime novels.
Let's talk about it.
It's an obsession in my mind because on one hand, I think there's too much. And on the other hand, I think it's absolutely appropriate, depending on the thing. Michael Novis said, who a person has sex with and what their sex is like can tell you a lot about a character. So I get that. And he writes beautiful sex scenes. Other times, it's just thrown in there for no reason. Your sex scenes, there's a good amount of sex in the novel, but it's all fade to black. We don't get the gory details. Why is that?
That's very much by design. I think...
What if I want the juicy stuff?
Well, you got to wait for the next book. No. I think part of what makes those type of scenes sexy is using your imagination a little bit within that too. I don't think it's always as fun to have all those gory details, you know, kind of spelt out sometimes. When it calls for it, that's great. But I think, you know, the way that I use the scenes, I try to use them in ways that really move the story forward, that really, you know, connect the characters in ways that they need to be connected, again, to move the story forward. I'm also personally they're not my favorite thing to write, to tell you the truth. So I feel I always want to tread lightly on that line of going too far as well. I just don't always think for my stories that is necessary to go full out for all of the scenes. I think it's a little bit sexier sometimes to leave some of that to the imagination, or even sexier sometimes to show the aftermath, you know, the morning after, and those little hints of what happened the night before, like someone threw something out or someone has a bruise or, you know, a sore neck or, you know, some of that is fun to have fun with too. So yeah, I think that's more my speed when it comes to the sex scenes.
I think it can be sexier too. Let the reader fill in the blanks, what they want to fill in there.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a writer's group in Facebook, which I tend to stay away from because there's a lot of bad advice, but somebody was complaining about they're reading novels where the characters have unprotected sex.
Mm.
They were furious about it and how irresponsible that was for a writer and went on and on about it. And my response to them was, in my novels, I don't say that they wear condoms. I also don't say that they don't wear condoms.
Right.
Whichever the reader feels most comfortable with, that's what they're doing.
Right, right.
Let them fill in the blanks.
Yeah, that is the thing that I think, you know, you leave to them to fill in the blanks in a lot of instances. But I think that's also just writer's choice. If they really want to push that message and, you know, promote safe sex, that's fantastic. But I think that is artist's choice.
I agree.
But yeah. But I think to your point, I think it is one of those things that maybe your brain, even when I'm thinking when I, you know, read scenes that are like that, I think your brain kind of just fills in that blank a lot of times, perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
So The Other Side of the Mirror was released on December 15th.
Which was my birthday, actually.
That was your 40th birthday.
It was.
So welcome to Over the Hill and Gay Years.
Thank you. Thanks, I guess.
actually, those days, I think, are not as bad as they used to be. So you're safe.
Thank you.
You said it was a surprise release. How did you keep it a secret and why?
I kept it a secret because I wanted it to be like my big 40th thing to release this book. And so everyone that I worked with kind of knew, you know, this is kind of going to be under wraps. I'm going to release it, you know, on my birthday. Everyone kind of signed, you know, NSAs, you know, all that. So it wasn't that difficult to actually keep it under wraps. I'm good at keeping a secret. But yeah, the release, I definitely wanted that to be my big 40th thing. And another fun fact is that everyone involved with this project, from my beta readers to my editor to the photographer, you know, who did the cover, they were all either queer or they were people of color or they were both in some cases, you know, and that was very intentional. I think it's great to write about diversity. I want to include diversity, but I also wanted to bring those voices to the table and really support and hire people within our own community when it came to this project. So that's kind of a fun fact that I don't think I've actually talked about a lot. A big thank you to all those people who had a hand in the release.
Well, one thing you mentioned is that you're a shameless thrill seeker and you love roller coasters. Roller coasters scare the shit out of me.
Okay, so question though, does your husband like roller coasters?
Yes.
See, and that's always the way it goes. Mine doesn't like roller coasters, but I love it. See?
Uh-huh. Yeah, we went to, not my husband and I, it was way before I knew him. I think it was with my family, went to Six Flags in Cincinnati, I believe it was.
Fun.
I sat on a bench a lot.
And see, that's tough for us because we need that roller coaster buddy. You got to have that ride or die person that's going to ride all the crazy roller coasters with you and scream and have fun. And yeah.
What's the roller coaster that's inside at Disneyland?
Oh, gosh.
Space Mountain.
Yes, yes.
Now, it's funny that as scared of as I am about roller coasters, I don't mind Space Mountain at all.
Probably because it's inside.
Yeah, and it's not really that wild of a roller coaster. It's just, I think that it's dark.
Yeah.
So I was surprised that I was kind of okay with it. The weird thing that bothered me, and I'm just weird this way, I guess. I kept worrying somebody might throw a wrench or something.
A wrench?
Because we're in the dark. Who knows what somebody's going to do?
I don't think they would let them on the ride with like wrenches.
I wouldn't think so. I don't know why that.
Maybe a cell phone phone?
Both times I wrote it, that was in my head. So I have no idea. What was the best or the scariest one that you've been on?
Oh, my favorite. I don't even think it's even there any longer. I know they changed the name when the park changed its name. It used to be King's Dominion. Mm-hmm. And then I think it became Paramount King's Dominion or something. But it used to be called the Rebel Yell, which is very Southern, I know. And I see that now. but it used to be the Rebel Yell, and it had two tracks. One went forwards, one went backwards. So I would say the Rebel Yell backwards at nighttime. Absolutely. Ooh. Yeah. Tough to beat. And it was an old wooden roller coaster, which they don't really make anymore.
There was a push. I was going to bring that up. The metal roller coasters became the big thing, probably because they last longer and that sort of thing. There was a push for a while, and I know some parks were putting back in wooden roller coasters because they felt like people liked the creaking and that kind of scary feel. What do you prefer? Do you prefer the wood or the metal?
These days, and maybe this is like a 40 thing, now that I've crossed over, I'm going to go with metal. But back in the day, I was definitely about the wood. There was one, it wasn't the Rebel Yell. And if anyone is listening to this and has been to King's Dominion, like, you know what I'm talking about. It's, I forget the name of it, but you would be waiting in line and you would see the roller coaster go by and the entire structure would shake.
Yes.
Yeah. So, And as soon as I'm sure we hang up, I'll remember what it is. But yeah, that is a little unnerving.
Now that you're in Vegas, have you ridden the roller coaster at the top of the Stratosphere?
Not yet.
Okay. It's on your list. I'm going to share a little secret with you. Now, it may have changed.
Okay.
When I lived in Vegas, which was many, many moons ago, locals would not ride that ride.
Why is that?
It was known for not being that well put together. Well, the Stratosphere is not known for being very well put together. And the roller coaster was on top of that. So I don't know whether that was true or just rumor, but it was hard to find a local that was willing to ride that ride. Let's hope that's changed.
But you know what? That probably won't stop me from riding it.
It'll add to the thrill.
Yeah.
Will we derail? That's going to be cool.
I mean, you know, if you got to go sometime.
And you might as well having fun on top of the Stratosphere. Exactly.
Exactly. Exactly.
In your bio, something I found curious, you mentioned you're an activist, mm-hmm. but you didn't elaborate what. What are you involved with?
So having just moved to Las Vegas, I haven't, you know, really done a whole lot here, but I definitely want to get involved with the gay community center here. Back in Richmond, I was a founding member of Gay Pride Virginia. Richmond went maybe, I think, 2 years without a Pride festival. And I was on the board and the committee for kind of reviving that and getting Pride kind of, you know, back in the works. So I did that. I was a board member at the gay community center there, served on a couple of different boards and volunteered a lot of time, did a couple of fundraisers to help with the community center there. Richmond has a really fantastic LGBTQ scene. And I think today they're actually celebrating a Pride festival at the marketplace there. The first year that we did Pride, it was actually there at the market. So it's kind of nice to kind of see that kind of go full circle. I'm wishing them a happy Pride today. And I really do miss my Richmond family, and I'm eager to get into the scene here in Vegas and hopefully volunteer some time at the community center and at different events and fundraisers that they have.
It's really shocking a city the size of Richmond would not have a Pride event for 2 years in a row.
Yeah, that was way back in the day.
Okay.
Yeah, way, way back in the day. And the organization since then has changed names to Virginia Pride. That's how long ago this was. But yeah, so being a part of that process and putting on an event of that size, you know, it's not an easy feat, you know, raising money from the community at different bars and, you know, all of that. I loved it. I loved it though. And I had just moved to Richmond. So for me, that was a great way to get involved, to give back, to meet people, to make friends, and, you know, that I still have today. So now that things are kind of reopening here in Vegas and things are better, I'm hoping to get out there and start volunteering some too.
Well, I'll share my experience with Vegas. When I lived there, the Gay and Lesbian Center was a tiny little house running on a shoestring budget, trying to have as many events as they possibly could.
Sounds familiar.
But it wasn't that many. But somehow they got a grant and were able to get a therapist on staff.
Oh, fantastic.
I think he was the only person on staff. I think everybody else were volunteers.
Okay.
He was instrumental in helping me come out. I was in Vegas when I came out of the closet.
Oh, that's great.
Not to everyone, but that was the start.
Yeah, that's great. And happy Pride Month, by the way.
Oh, same to you. Same to you. So I know the center is no longer a tiny house. I've seen the pictures of it and it looks like a big, beautiful building. So
nice.
I hope it's a good experience for you getting active with them.
Thank you. I'm excited too. And, you know, I tend to work from home mostly anyway. So, I mean, volunteering is a great way for me. I'm very introverted, by the way. It's a great way for me to kind of get out there. And if I'm out there, I want to be doing something that's making an impact and giving back. So I'm excited to learn more and start making some plans.
Well, I haven't lived anywhere that you've lived while you're doing your activism, but I'm going to say thank you anyway.
Sure, sure. And thank you for what you're doing. I think, you know, this show is very important as well, sharing our stories and our voices. So thank you for everything you're doing.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Before we wrap up, we have to do awkward questions authors get.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
And I don't know if you know, I surveyed dozens of authors and said, what are some difficult questions that you've gotten, some strange questions you've gotten, or really bizarre questions you've gotten? So they're on the wheel, and I'm going to spin the wheel and see what you get.
Okay. Let's do it.
So hold on.
Okay.
Okay. You ready for your question?
I'm ready.
Can there be at least two oral scenes and one all the way scene in your next novel?
That's a very weird question and very specific.
First of all. And actually it came up just recently, but it's the one that popped up. So
read that again.
Can there be at least two oral scenes and one all the way in your next novel?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I want to go with yes. There could be.
Go with yes.
Yeah, there very well could be. I'm going to fade to black because, you know, that's how I roll.
Okay, but there we go. Cheater. Actually, if you go fade to black, it happens in every book.
There you go. I've already had a ton of them in this one, then.
If that's what they want, they got it.
There you go. Ask and you shall receive. Exactly.
Well, Chris, it's been great to have you on. I really appreciate the time. Let remind everybody, this is Christopher Murphy, and his most recent novel is The Other Side of the Mirror. And before that, just a year before that, it was Where the Boys Are.
Yes.
And you'll find him on Amazon and other outlets. I will put his website in the show notes, as I always do.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a ton of fun.
Be sure to subscribe to Queer Writers of Crime wherever you hear our show. Tell a friend, too. Thank you for listening.